this is my first opportunity to be at Holden on the teaching staff. A long time ago, my wife and I were here on the volunteer staff and did a variety of things. Karen was a cook. I was a fire marshal, of all things. I think that anybody's life was in my hands. Right. Now we're back with a couple young boys, a three-year-old Joshua and an eight-year-old Joel. And it's fun to be here and to experience Holden with them. So it's a privilege to be here with you tonight and to share a little bit of what I know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer with you, and hopefully to spend some time talking together about him. Most of my work while I'm in the village is going to be on population-related stuff. I've had the privilege of going to Cairo to a big UN meeting last September, and been doing some other work there, so I'm going to focus on that sort of stuff later this week and next week. But, you know, I thought about being here for 2 weeks, and I thought, boy, it'd be a shame to not do something on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. We sit now between Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day, and remembering and thinking, reflecting on the significance of that. And I think it's maybe fitting in between those 2 days to think about, reflect upon the witness of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How many of you have heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Raise your hands. Good, Lucy. Yes. All right. So, in fact, I'm sure much of what I'll have to say for you won't be new. Maybe some of the information I'll share with you will be. But I think because we all know so much, we'll have a very rich and productive conversation together. I decided to focus this evening on, you know, with one session you have to focus on something, and it's pretty hard to cover all of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's thought in one lecture or one presentation. And so I thought, well, why don't I just focus on Bonhoeffer's, come on in, folks, there are a few more seats over here. I know there's some folding chairs over in that corner. There's this chair.
We'll go around behind you.
Are right.
You going to get one? Oh,
that's
cool.
Go ahead. Watch the
board. I'll see
it. So this session is going to focus on Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Jewish question. Bonhoeffer's response to the plight of the Jews during Nazi Germany. I'll give you some background on his family at the outset, and then talk primarily about some significant events from 1933 to 1943, when he was arrested. So that's the plan that I have for this evening. And before I get into it, I just want to mention one resource that's over in the bookstore, which you may want to look at. It's a novel of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life, written by a woman by the name of Mary Glasner, called The Cup of Wrath. And then I forget what the subtitle is, but it has something to do with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But the whole novel is a very good historical novel that takes Eberhard Bethke's definitive biography, which is in the Holden Library, and you know, sort of tells that great story in the form of a novel and fills in some of the gaps that Bethke wasn't able to cover in very imaginative ways. So it's very faithful to the historical record, but it's also very creative in its attempt to fill in some gaps. So I commend it to you. It's very easy to read, and it's an enjoyable read. It's as good as any novel you'll buy anywhere. So
what was the name of it?
The Cup of Wrath, yes. By Mary Glasner. It's in the bookstore on the shelf that I think was faculty teaching staff recommendations. I think there are only 3 copies, so don't be intimidated by its size. It's large print inside. So anyway, that's one thing to say. Now, when I did this lecture, or this is a lecture that I gave in January of this year for a special course at Luther on the Holocaust, on the moral significance of the Holocaust, and I was invited to come in and give a lecture on that. I have taught a course at Luther on Bonhoeffer, a semester-long course. But that invitation gave me a chance to reflect specifically on Bonhoeffer and the Jews. And when I went through some photographs, I'm sorry this isn't up any higher, I hope you all can see that. This is Dietrich Bonhoeffer at age 17. And I thought for my audience then, this was a pretty important photograph, you know, to see someone who in many respects for a college student is your contemporary, and look, you know, how his life went, and look what he made with his life. I'll talk more about that in a minute. He's, for those of us who think we are scholars, Bonhoeffer puts us to shame, but that's later. No, you know, just look at that gaze, a very penetrating gaze, a very bright man, a very creative man, a very compassionate man, a great leader, and ultimately a Christian martyr. So I'll talk more about that in a minute. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was executed by hanging in the Flossenbürg concentration camp on April 9th, 1945, which was 11 days before the camp was liberated by the Allied forces. 11 days, and he would have lived. Yeah, probably would have lived. He wasn't emaciated. How is it that this young man died at the age of 39? What was it that led him to Flossenbürg? What was it that led to him being incarcerated and ultimately executed by the Nazi regime? I think I'll just leave that on for a minute. Well, one of the reasons Bonhoeffer turned out the way he did is because of who his family was. Dietrich was born into a large family. His parents, Paula and Karl Bonhoeffer, were both from fairly wealthy aristocratic families of Prussia. Bonhoeffer was the sixth child in a family of eight children, and he was a twin. His twin sister, Sabina, was a close friend throughout his life, and her husband was a very important figure in his life. Back to his parents briefly, both well-educated, relatively aristocratic. His father, Karl, was the professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Berlin. This was the highest ranking position in those disciplines in the entire nation of Germany. He was the expert in Germany on those subjects. His mother, Paula, mother of a family of, you know, eight children, homeschooled all of her children up to, I forget exactly the level, but the first several years, and kind of ruled the roost, Eberhard Bethke, Bonhoeffer's biographer and best friend, says. But Bethke also says that his mother was the kind of person who simply brought out the best in people. So two very powerful, molding kind of parents. His father was sort of the standard, stern, standoffish father, and his mother was warm and loving and embracing and developed the gifts of her children. Bonhoeffer was born with remarkable musical gifts and was playing Bach or sonatas at a very early age, and was a master pianist, harpsichordist, etc. So parents were significant. However, it would be his siblings, and especially his brothers and his brother-in-law, who would be probably the most important influences on his life. Let me put some of those pictures up on this now. His eldest brother, Carl Friedrich, became a brilliant physicist and had many options in Germany, split the hydrogen atom, and had an offer to teach at the University of Chicago, which he turned down because the offer came right, I think it was 1940, just when war was almost ready to break out, and Carl Friedrich did not feel that he could be in the United States while his fellow German people were going to face war. He had to be with the nation. As much as he opposed it, he needed to be with it. And so he and Dietrich left the United States. Dietrich came over to the United States on a second trip, and they both came to the same conclusion independently of each other and left on the same ship to go back to Germany and to face the consequences of the war. I think that says something about the character of these men. And Carl Friedrich was a man of great character. Another older brother, Walter, died during the First World War. I'm sorry, I don't have pictures of these two, so I don't have them up here, but the death of Walter was a grievous shock and loss to the family, but it drove home to Dietrich at an early age. He was born in 1906, so he was maybe 8 or 9 when his brother died. It drove home to Bonhoeffer at an early age what the cost of war was. He understood it in experiential terms, or in existential terms. It wasn't an abstract thing. He knew what it meant. He knew what war meant. And then, let me get to these guys. Was there a question? Okay. These are the three that perished with him. His oldest brother, Klaus, and his wife, Emmy. Push that up just a little higher. Sorry, this isn't any higher. Klaus was trained as a lawyer, especially focused on international law. And after Bonhoeffer was arrested, the conspiracy, which I'll get to later, had to go on. Some people had to fill those voids of people who were arrested. And Klaus, who up to that point had sort of stayed back a little bit, whereas Dietrich had gotten involved, when Dietrich was arrested, Klaus took his place. But 2 weeks after Dietrich was executed, Klaus was executed as well, along with Rüdiger Schlieger, a brother-in-law. Ursula, Bonhoeffer's sister Ursula. Klaus and Rüdiger were assassinated executed on the same day by a firing squad. And then this is the key figure, Hans von Donani, and his wife Christel, or Christine Bonhoeffer. Hans is the man who invited Dietrich to join the conspiracy. Hans worked with Colonel Oster and other members of one conspiracy within Germany. There unfortunately weren't many, and none of them were successful. But Hans worked very faithfully over the course of several years to bring down Hitler, first nonviolently and then ultimately violently, all to no avail. But it was Hans who was, in some respects, Dietrich was his confessor. Hans had a guilty conscience and wanted to talk about these things. Bonhoeffer listened, and at a certain point later I'll talk about Hans recruited Bonhoeffer to work in the conspiracy. Think about this, eight children, eight spouses, 16 people, 4 executed. Think about what that means for a family. I mean, obviously many families during the Second World War, especially in Germany, suffered grievous losses, but think of them being these kinds of losses, executions, and executions as traitors. I'll talk more about that at the end. Very ignoble deaths for all of them, but a very powerful, high-powered, brilliant family who felt immense obligation and responsibility to their nation. And it was on the basis of those, of that privilege and that responsibility, that these men and women took the actions that they did. Turn this off for just a minute. So just some brief comments about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's theological career. By the tender age of 14 or 15 years of age, Dietrich knew that he wanted to be a theologian. And when he announced this to his family, everyone sort of, you know, the glass sort of stops in mid-motion. You what? It wasn't that his family wasn't religious. They were, but sort of in the traditional German way. You know, we're good Christians, but you don't have to go to church to prove it, or you don't have to be active churchgoers. Religious education hadn't been that aggressive in his life. His brothers, of course, were physicists and lawyers. His father was this leading medical doctor in Germany. And here is Dietrich saying, I want to be a theologian. Well, it took people a while to get used to it, but pretty soon they realized this was this man's calling, and he turned out to be a great theologian and a great, it continues to be an important theologian. For those of us who are working on dissertations and doctoral work, he's also a humbling figure because he finished his PhD in Christian theology at the tender age of 21. Now, things are a little different in Germany, but they're not that different. The title of his dissertation was Sanctorum Communio, the Communion of Saints. And that focus on the church, the importance of the church, the mission of the church, remained the central focus of his theological reflection throughout his life. Two ways in which he addressed that concern were through two important questions. Who is Jesus Christ for us today? And what is the responsibility of Christians in the modern world? Those two questions drove his theological reflection throughout his life and came out in different ways, in different books, most notably The Cost of Discipleship, which I'll talk about in a minute, and his volume Ethics, which he wrote while he was working in the conspiracy, and then also in terms of his letters and papers from prison, along with a few other works as well. So that's just a little bit about his theological career. Now I want to focus primarily on the years of 1933 to 1943 and give a little more specific attention within those years to Bonhoeffer's response to the, quote, Jewish question. In 1933 is the year when the Nazis came to power, when Hitler came to power. I just pulled this out. These pictures are from a book also edited by Eberhard Bethke, Bonhoeffer's friend and biographer, called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, A Life in Pictures. I haven't looked to see if it's in the library here, but if it is, you should get it and look at it. It's a wonderful collection of photos. But the election Adolf Hitler to the position, or the appointment of, it was the election of Hitler to the position of Reich's Chancellor, was obviously a pivotal moment in the history of Germany. When Rudiger Schlieger learned of it, he came into the Bonhoeffer home and said, "This means war." He was right. And most of the family thought it meant war as well. At this time, Dietrich was working as a lecturer at the University of Berlin. He was serving as a secretary, a youth secretary in the World Alliance of Churches, I think a predecessor to the World Council of Churches. And he was also working as a pastor in a poor Berlin neighborhood. And this is a picture of him with some of the youth that he worked with in that poor neighborhood. He deliberately chose to work in a poor neighborhood. He wanted to work there. One of the reasons for that is that he had gone to New York in the early 30s and went to Union Seminary, which is the school that I'm still working on my PhD with. And while he was there, spent some time in Harlem and was really impressed by the spiritual life African Americans in the United States, really interested in spirituals, but also realized the significance of the power of the gospel in the midst of poverty and alienation. And so at an early, some people understand the theology of the cross intuitively, and the rest of us, you just have to keep hammering away, you know, and pretty soon we figure it out. But Bonhoeffer had an intuitive sense of that theology of the cross and understood that God is with those who suffer, and was immediately drawn, therefore, to Harlem, and when he came back, wanted to work with the poor or with underprivileged people in a poor urban neighborhood of Berlin. Well, after Hitler was named chancellor on January 30th, 1933, as fate would have it, Bonhoeffer had an invitation to give a radio address. And I don't remember exactly who it was that invited him to do it, but he had the opportunity. And so he made use of it. And what he did was criticize his nation's sort of unswerving allegiance to this man, Adolf Hitler, and the danger of being blind in one's obedience or patriotism towards this figure. Why do I mention this? Because just as he was reaching the apex of his criticism, the switch went off. Well, was it because he exceeded his time? Maybe. Or maybe it was because someone already in 1933 was paying attention to the critics of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. But in any case, Bonhoeffer from an early point was a critic of National Socialism and an outspoken critic. Obviously paid the price later. In April of that year, 1933, there was a national conference of the German Christians, they were called, which amounted to a fervent celebration of Adolf Hitler, the election, or the ascension of Adolf Hitler, and just sort of the swoon of patriotism and power in the nation. And so there was this national conference of what were being called German Christians, and at that conference, two kind of slogans emerged. One was that the church would now be the Reich Church, the Church of the German Reich. And another slogan that emerged during this time was racial conformity. And a month later, that would be very clear what that meant. It meant Aryan folks could be Christians, and anybody else who had any kind of, especially Jews, that kind of blood was suspect and couldn't be considered as legitimate within the church. Well, this sort of language of the Reich Church and racial conformity led to reflection on the Jewish question. And Bonhoeffer writes, and I forget exactly where this is from, Eberhard Bethke has this in his biography, Bonhoeffer says the following: "We are in no way concerned with the question of whether our members of German stock can continue to share responsibility with Jews for the communion of the church." One of the things this conference was saying was that if you have Jewish blood in you, you don't have a right to serve as a leader of the church. You shouldn't be one of our pastors. And Bonhoeffer is addressing this Jewish question and is saying that we are in no way concerned with the question of whether our members of German stock can continue to share responsibility with Jews for the communion of the church. Rather, it is the task of the Christian proclamation to say, here, where Jews and Germans stand together under God's word is the church. Here it is proven whether we are the church or whether the church is still the church. That's pretty strong language. He was unequivocal about this. I put this up here just to show you that this is a Christian altar with a swastika in the background. This is Hitler. This is a nice piece of propaganda they used early on to show, you know, the devout Adolf going to church, coming back, the cross perfectly positioned above his head. It's difficult to go into a lot of the detail of how Adolf Hitler tried to take over the German church, and I have one more overhead to show you later.
When you say German Christians, are you talking about Protestants?
Yes.
And even more defined than that?
Well, the whole distinction of Protestant, you know, isn't quite the same as it is. The American distinction of different kinds of Protestants isn't quite the same as it is in Germany, but certainly a good portion of these folks that were part of the German Christians were Lutherans, without a doubt. And that's one reason why Bonhoeffer became part of a group called the Confessing Church. So I'll talk about that in just a second. But, you know, as much as Bonhoeffer spoke out early against this prejudice and repression of people who had Jewish ancestry and who were, and by the way, I neglected to add something important at the outset. One of his sisters married a man by the name of Gerhard Leipholz. Gerhard Leipholz was one of the nation's foremost constitutional lawyers. He also happened to be of Jewish ancestry. He was baptized as a Christian, but he was still a Jew. And so later, he would have to give up his position of teaching law in Germany, and was forced into retirement and ultimately forced to flee to Switzerland. Why do I say this? Because in the same year, at the same time that this, in April of 1933, that this conference was taking place with the German Christians, and Bonhoeffer was speaking out and saying, if we can't be, you know, Christians under the word of God, then we're not the church anymore. Bonhoeffer made a choice that he regretted the rest of his life. Gerhard Leipoldt's father died. Someone had to bury him. He was a Jew. His son had converted, but Gerhard's father was still, had not been baptized at least. And Bonhoeffer was asked to do the service. And he was advised by his closest friends to not do it. And, you know, after the funeral was over and someone else had buried Gerhard's father, Dietrich was racked with guilt and felt so badly that he had done this, because he recognized the hypocrisy of saying one thing and doing another. And frankly, he didn't do that much anymore. So I add that to show you that the guy was human, huh? And he was a chauvinist, but most of us still are, and many most were then. I don't mean that in a deprecating way, just an objective way. He was a fairly chauvinist guy. But so were almost all of his contemporaries at that point. But anyway, the real crunch came when Hitler introduced this thing called the Aryan Clause, which simply meant that if you held a civil service job, that meant if you were a university lecturer, or if you were a judge, or any position paid for by the government, you had to be an Aryan, and you couldn't have Jewish ancestry. And so this obviously directly affected Dietrich's brother-in-law, Gerhard Leipoldt. And so in May of 1943, Bonhoeffer spoke out again about the Jewish question in another essay. And this is what he had to say. He said three things. He said, first of all, the church has an obligation to tell the state when the state is doing something that is unconstitutional. And Bonhoeffer felt that this exclusive focus on Arianism was unconstitutional, and also that at this point that the state was meddling in the affairs of the church. Bonhoeffer is a Lutheran. Lutherans operate with this notion of the two kingdoms. Bonhoeffer criticized it, but at this point he appropriated it and said, you know, let the church be the church and the state should be the state, but one of the responsibilities of the church is for the church to criticize the state when the state oversteps its boundaries. So that's the first thing that Christians can say in response to this question of the Aryan Clause and the Jewish question. The second thing that Christians have before them is the obligation to bandage all victims who fall under the wheel of society. That's his language, fall under the wheel. So he says, Christians, the church has an unconditional obligation to all victims in society, even if they do not belong to the Christian community. Here he's speaking clearly about Jews and the discrimination that they were experiencing and the injustice that they were experiencing. But then he says one more thing that is so radical that it's hard to believe it comes out of the mouth of a Lutheran theologian. He says, and third, the church may need to not only bandage the victims under the wheel, but put a spoke in the wheel itself. Put a wrench into the works. What does that mean? It means work to bring down the state. Now this is 1933, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer didn't do that, but he did do it in 1940 to 43.
I think it's exciting to see what he says, but it's interesting that now with the church, that at least in America, we've fallen away from that. It's like the church is, we don't have that much power, and the government's all powering, and the church is just a little side thought at the most.
Save that thought, and let's come back to it at the end, because I want us to talk about what is the significance of Dietrich Bonhoeffer for today. What should the church be doing in this contemporary kind of context? Are we hopelessly acculturated? Are we indistinguishable from the rest of society, or are we such a small remnant, such a small society, such a small group that we couldn't do anything anyway to change the juggernaut of American culture? But hang on to that, and let's yeah.
Where did Bonhoeffer get this? These the three things he was saying, was it just from his own beliefs, or was it from the Bible, or where did he get these two doctrines or whatever?
Well, I don't think there are any footnotes in his essay, but certainly the first two elements are very standard Lutheran two kingdoms things. It's the third one, where the church or work to subvert the state, that is the most dramatic and unprecedented, and earned him a lot of criticism. So that's just Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I mean, that's why he is who he is. He dared to think a different thought. Now, I'm sure there are lots of good theological foundations for it, but the bottom line is he broke away from a very strong tradition that said the church doesn't do that sort of stuff in relationship to the state. Anyway, as a result of all of this, obviously the church became involved in a struggle for its autonomy, for its integrity, and a movement called the Confessing Church was born after the election of Hitler in 1933, and as Hitler moved increasingly to consolidate, infiltrate, and control German Christian communities. Let me just put up another overhead that illustrates that a little bit. This is a this is a poster that was apparently widely disseminated at the time. And this man over here is Reichsbishop Müller, who was appointed by Hitler to be the head of the Deutsche Evangelische Kirche, or the state church of Protestant church of Germany, not elected by the congregations, but appointed by Adolf Hitler. Well, that's one major problem that the church had with Hitler, was who is this guy and what's he doing running the show? This says, as best as Walt and I could interpret it, the Reichsbishop leads Christendom onward, or outward, or forward. And then down here at the bottom, it's hard to see this, the bishop is saying to one of these pastors who are holding crosses shaped in the form of swastikas, hey you there, that crucifix should be a little more to the right. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's one of those things that you just can't believe exists, but of course it does, and it's incredibly tragic. It's a way to graphically illustrate the kind of sullying of the church which National Socialism tried, which Hitler tried to do.
Who published this poster, is it?
No, it's sincere. It's not. It's that's what I meant. Why you can't believe it? Yeah, I know it looks like satire. Certainly does. But no, it was sincere. Yeah. So without going, I mean, this is one place where you have to draw a line. And I just decided I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Confessing Church and all that. But in any case, Bonhoeffer becomes a significant leader in the Confessing Church. The Christians who opposed this kind of interference of the meddling of the state in church affairs. Bonhoeffer was an important figure in helping to draft the Barmen Declaration, which was an important document that emerged from this Confessing Church as opposition to this interference in the state. But Bonhoeffer also challenged that church to speak out more forcefully and consistently for the Jews. And that was a different question. It was one thing to criticize the state for meddling in the church's affairs. It was another thing to take on the Jewish question. But Bonhoeffer consistently tried to get these folks to do that. And some did, and others didn't. So That's just one reality. During this period of time, from 1936 to 1939, Bonhoeffer was asked to run what amounted to an illegal seminary for these confessing churches. He did a wonderful job with it, and that's another whole lecture of Finkenwald and the experiment in theological education that Bonhoeffer created and successfully pulled off. It was an incredible thing. They really were technically illegal and ultimately were shut down by the Gestapo. During this time, Bonhoeffer took a small group of people. I don't think the seminary candidates were ever more than maybe 35 or 40, and really molded their lives in a terrific way. One of the ways he did that was to appropriate various spiritual disciplines that he had learned when he was in the United States and visited Quaker communities. When he lived in England, he lived in London for a while, he visited some Anglican religious communities, and he loved the chanting. How many of you have listened to the CD chant? Are you familiar with that? It was a top 10 seller. Isn't that a group of French monks? Spanish, excuse me. Who sang, and it's Gregorian chants primarily? Yeah. Bonhoeffer told his seminary candidates that only those who speak out for the Jews should have the privilege of singing Gregorian chants. Now, that's an interesting way of thinking about the relationship of aesthetics and ethics, beauty and justice. Bonhoeffer wove those two together in his character, in his life, in his writing, and tried to develop that relationship in the people that he touched. I think that's a great illustration of who he was and the kind of impact he tried to make on people. During that period of time, from 1936 to 1939, while he was the lead, or the director of the seminary, he wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. How many of you have read it? So, most of you. A staple of good Lutheran, good courses in Lutheran theology. So let me just, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, let me just read a couple excerpts just to give you a flavor of it. The central focus of the book, or not focus, but one of the main points of the book is Bonhoeffer's distinction between cheap and costly grace. And let me just let Bonhoeffer speak for himself. We Lutherans have gathered like eagles around the carcass of cheap grace, and there we have drunk of the poison which has killed the life of following Christ. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again. It is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die. Now, those are all three different quotes that I pulled out of The Cost of Discipleship. They don't all occur in that order. But this emphasis on self-sacrifice framed Bonhoeffer's nonviolent approach to political resistance during this time. Remember, war hasn't broken out yet. It's still 1936 to 1939. And in The Cost of Discipleship, he says the following about resistance of evil. The right way to requite evil, according to Jesus, is not to resist it. The only way to overcome evil is to let it run itself to a standstill, because it does not find the resistance it is looking for. Resistance merely creates further evil and adds fuel to the flames. Now, why do I say this? Well, because Bonhoeffer, in a matter of a few years, is going to become a part of a conspiracy that eventually is going to try to assassinate Adolf Hitler. But at this point in his life, 1936 to 1939, Bonhoeffer is very much a Christian pacifist, speaks out about on this topic frequently, challenges other theologians to wrestle with this. This, again, is a very un-Lutheran thing to do. Christian pacifism was not a traditional manifestation of the Lutheran faith in Germany over those previous 200 years. And so this was another thing that set Dietrich apart. How does he make that change from pacifism to responsible action, you know, on behalf of the conspiracy? I think that's a whole other lecture, whole other kind of thing, and it could have gone that way. But just leave that there for a minute, feel it, and I'll try to address it in just a minute. So I want to switch then from 1936 to 1939 to the year 1940. I said that Bonhoeffer had gone to the United States again. Frankly, he was ready to be called up for the draft. He wasn't eager to be shot, and he wasn't eager to support National Socialism. He wanted to stay in Germany doing anything else but that. It didn't work out. He went to the United States, had an offer to teach at Union Seminary, got there, and said, "I did the wrong thing." And within a matter of weeks, 1 or 2 weeks, came back to Germany and said, rolled the dice and said, let the chips fall where they may. When he came back, his brother-in-law, Hans von Donani, recruited him to be a member of the conspiracy that Donani was very much a part of. Donani worked for a man by the name of Colonel Oster, and Oster worked in the Abwehr. The Abwehr was the counterintelligence organization of the German military. And they had this very well-developed group working with the generals to try to bring down Hitler. At the outset, the conspiracy was working with these generals to persuade them to simply launch a military coup which would depose Hitler. Hitler would be psychologically examined by Bonhoeffer's father, Karl Friedrich, the leading expert in Germany, and then Hitler would be tried for war crimes, particularly crimes against the Jews. Donani kept a very large file called the Chronicles of Shame, which documented painstakingly all of the violations of human rights during the Nazi era. And it was that kind of legal data that was going to be used in the trial of Hitler. Well, they tried on several occasions to persuade those generals, and for various reasons it never worked out. And so about this time of 1940, or actually a little later, they realize that it's going to be necessary to try to assassinate Hitler. During this period of time, Bonhoeffer's primary role from 1940 to 43 was to use his ecumenical contacts in the West as a means of communication between the conspiracy and the Allies. Bonhoeffer was active in this World Alliance of Churches and had many ecumenical contacts in London and in the United States. That was very helpful to the conspirators. During this period of time, Bonhoeffer lived a double life. He had to play the public role of scholar and pastor, but he also led the secret life as a spy. During this period, he never accepted any remuneration from the Abwehr, because he didn't want to earn money for being, what his country regarded as a traitor. He didn't want to earn money as a spy. How did he live? He used money left in the country by Gerhard Leipholz, his Jewish ancestry brother-in-law, who with his wife Ursula had been forced to flee to Switzerland. And it was that money that sustained Bonhoeffer during this period of time. Very interesting, huh? That this, how he managed to do it. Anyway, from 1940 to 43, he worked on his book, which was unfinished at the time of his death, called Ethics. The book offers a fervent criticism of unrealistic idealism and argues for a Christian ethic that takes very seriously historical circumstances and situations. Let me just read you one paragraph. Bonhoeffer says, "This leads us away from any kind of abstract ethic and towards an ethic which is entirely concrete. What can and must be said is not what is good once and for all, but the way in which Christ takes form among us here and now. Christ did not, like a moralist, love a theory of the good, but he loved the real man or the real person. He was not like some philosopher interested in the universally valid, but rather in that which is of help to the real and concrete human being. It was Bonhoeffer's compassion for real and concrete human beings that led him to make strong criticisms of the church. After learning for the first time of Nazi atrocities associated with the Final Solution, Bonhoeffer wrote in his book Ethics the following: "The church has often denied to the outcast and to the despised the compassion which she owes them. She was silent when she should have cried out, because the blood of the innocent was crying aloud to heaven. She failed to speak the right word in the right way and at the right time. She has not resisted to the uttermost the apostasy of faith, and she has brought upon herself the guilt of the godlessness of the masses." That theological reflection was prompted by, Baitke says it was prompted by Bonhoeffer's first awareness of the extermination of Jews in concentration camps. So, at this period of time, you know, Germany's at war, incredible human rights violations are taking place, and suddenly some of that pacifist rhetoric, idealist rhetoric of the cost of discipleship is changed or altered in response to concrete, real historical problems. And Bonhoeffer begins to wrestle with what constitutes real patriotism. Perhaps the patriotic thing to do in this context is to work to overthrow precisely those things which are destroying truth, justice, law, beauty, etc. And so that is precisely what he did, and he wasn't that active, frankly, in the assassination attempts. He was more of a communications conduit. He did play a more significant role in an effort of the conspiracy to smuggle 24 Jews out of Germany to safety in Switzerland. These were Jewish friends or contacts of the conspirators, and they risked a great deal to get these men and women and their children out of Germany before they would be shipped off to the camps, and they were successful. It took them 6 months. Bonhoeffer played an important role traveling back and forth to Geneva to set things up. But it was that operation that led to Bonhoeffer's arrest when the Gestapo discovered money that Hans von Donani and the Abwehr had withdrawn to help pay for the costs of both the exodus and the cost of maintaining this family in Switzerland. And so when the Gestapo discovered that, they tracked all the information backward and used that to discover one important portion of the conspiracy, which included Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So Bonhoeffer was therefore arrested on April 5th, 1943, and spent the next 2 years in various prisons until his execution on April 9th, 1945, only 11 days before the U.S. troops liberated Flossenbürg. And Bonhoeffer, Eberhard Baitke put together his book Ethics and published that, put together his letters and papers from prison and published that, and Bonhoeffer, I think, definitely had more of a theological impact after his death than before his death in Germany, and I hope or want to believe continues to be a very important theological figure today. So, having said that, it leaves us about 10 minutes still to talk a little bit about him and how you perceive his significance for today, or if you have questions of clarification about what I've said, or things you just want to add to what I've said, that would be great. So let me turn it over to you, and you respond or react however you wish. Oh, let me, while we're doing that, this is a picture of Dietrich while he was in Tegel prison. He was in Tegel most of his incarceration from 1943 to the end of 1944. And so this is what he looks like about 38, 39 years of age. Again, the whole prison era is a separate lecture that would be really fascinating to talk about. So, what do you think? Is Dietrich Bonhoeffer still significant for us today? You got us into that a little bit, thinking about a question. How about the rest of you? What do you think?
What do you think the allegiance to the 16th article of the Augsburg Confession had in the influence of the Lutheran Church to kind of go along with the Nazi regime and not speak out against it, mm-hmm. not speak out for the oppressed?
Yeah. But you're referring to the 16th article makes reference to just wars.
And being a soldier.
And being, yeah, right. Without a doubt, all of Bonhoeffer's students who are part of that Finkenwald seminary, still, many of them hankered after the opportunity to serve their country in the capacity of being a soldier. It's hard to understand, or at least as a chaplain in the military, this profound duty to the mother, to the fatherland, was ingrained, both culturally, theologically, and it's hard for us. As Americans, I think, Dave Peters was talking about this earlier, as Americans, you know, we're so egalitarian and individualistic, and patriotism probably falls a little further down the list, on our list of civic virtues or values. Well, not in Deutschland. Defense of the fatherland, duty to country was extremely important.
And that probably accounted for the fact that all Catholic priests signed an oath of allegiance to Hitler, and most Lutheran pastors also
right.
signed an oath of allegiance.
That's right. That's right. Which you should know, it was placed before them, and if they didn't sign it, they lost the pastorates. Mm-hmm. So there's a level of coercion there. You know, it's not like it was just a free and voluntary decision. But many of them, I don't think, anguished over it. Some, at least. What other kinds of thoughts does this presentation
spawn? I have a thought that just thinking past these pastors who fell in line with Hitler and all that from the church, after the war, was there ever any penitence on their part? Any great sense of, you know, they really did deny Christ?
You know, I'm not an expert on that. What I can say is that after the war, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was regarded as a traitor. And in fact was still regarded as a traitor legally for quite a while. I don't think that was removed. And do you know, Walt, when that? But I think it was like the 60s until that kind of official status of Bonhoeffer was a traitor was expunged from the historical, or, you know, was
repudiated. But I mean amongst the churchmen, not the country, but amongst
right. And I just don't know what happened after the war in terms of how the clergy wrestled with their complicity. And frankly, yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I just don't know how to answer it. It's not my field.
Well, but there were some contemporaries, Karl Barth,
yep.
I think, who worked, you know, with Bonhoeffer on the Declaration.
Yep.
Had a lot of admiration. Questions, but a lot of admiration.
Admiration.
For his action-oriented theology.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. Did you mean after the war or before
yes.
the war? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course, it's a huge piece.
I mean,
during
Barth
the
found,
war,
found
he
a way to get to Switzerland.
Yeah. Yeah. Other yes.
Well, if it wasn't known how the church. Felt about him after the war and with what attitude they took toward his teachings, then who was so interested to bring him out on this side?
Yeah.
And, is that rather an important thing in international Lutheranism to know what stand, I mean how they stood with him, where
yeah.
they can stand with him?
Bonhoeffer's work was brought to the United States by several people, but two of the most important figures were Paul Lehmann, Houtonic Union, and which Bonhoeffer had gotten to know at Union, and with whom Bonhoeffer communicated during the war, and Reinhold Niebuhr, with whom he had also studied, and of whom Niebuhr had extraordinarily high regard. So one group of folks that promoted Bonhoeffer's thought were major theological figures in the United States, and then later liberation theologians grasped onto Bonhoeffer, and one portion I didn't read was from Letters and Papers from Prison, in which Bonhoeffer talks about understanding what it's like to see the world from below, to comprehend reality from the perspective of those who suffer. Well, that's a major hallmark of liberation theology, and they, some of them, Bonino, Gutierrez, Boff, all connected in some way with Bonhoeffer's personal witness and with his theological emphasis on the theology of the cross and seeing the world from below. So, you know, both in North America, major theological figures were talking about the importance of Bonhoeffer's work, and then later in the 70s, liberation theologians were as well.
You know, his model of going from passivism to an active overthrow kind of thing has lots of implications.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of other people, Gandhi, for example, and what would be that shifting point for him, do you think?
Bonhoeffer says that there was never a conversion experience away from pacifism or something like that. And he sort of deliberately addresses that. And he wants to make it clear that I have not changed who I am. That how I theologically perceive the responsibility of Christians in the world has not changed. But what does change is the concrete form of Christ among us today. And by reflecting on it, essentially, you know, it's extremely dangerous. But at the same time, how many of us would deny that that was a responsible act? There may have been other things that could have been done. There's no doubt about that. But to try to bring down Hitler was probably a wise move, because most of the generals were simply afraid of losing their lives if they betrayed Hitler, and many did. Some did lose their lives. So there was good rationale, good justification. It was last resort, you know. I mean, if you're going to operate by those criteria. But Bonhoeffer talked about it primarily in terms of the responsibility, of his responsibility as a Christian, discerning the form of Christ today to preserve justice, truth, and law. And what he saw was the fruits of Western civilization going down the tubes. And he couldn't stand by as a privileged Prussian and allow that to happen. Think about who these people are. I mean, Donani is a lawyer, Oster's a colonel. These are not, you know, these are not the people in East Berlin that Bonhoeffer worked with in his internship. These are powerful men who had power and stature and tried to use it in a way to alter the course of their nation's history. And I think we need to understand Bonhoeffer in that context. He was part of a privileged group, and he had that choice. He could do something like that. Many people can't do that. Now, whether that means, you know, nonviolence goes out the window, I don't think Bonhoeffer believed that. He also believed that what he was doing was a sin, that they needed to repent for it, but it was a lesser of two evils. Makes it a little more complex than certainly the cost of discipleship led it to be, but then historical reality had changed, and life was more complex, different.
Gary? Common misconception that I think a lot of people have is that pacifism is passive.
Yeah.
Two root words, they're two different root words, and there are a couple of different kinds of pacifism. Two,
yeah.
There's a non-resistant pacifism where you don't do anything, and then there's the active, non-violent resistance.
Exactly.
The model of Jesus, Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah.
That was confusing when he read that passage. I don't think he should call himself a non-resistant pacifist. He was an active resistant.
Yes, exactly. But when you read that passage, that's what it sounds like. And it's unfortunate because, exactly, he was very active in resistance to the Nazis.
He was exposing himself to risk of suffering.
So absolutely.
I think it was, I don't know where he had that passivism.
Yeah. Well, he's being faithful to the Gospel of Matthew in that language of non-resistance. But you're absolutely right that personally, he certainly wasn't a non-resister. He didn't just go close himself off in a closet.
And Jesus wasn't a non-resister.
Absolutely not. That's right.
Non-violent resister.
He resisted evil in a variety of ways. Yeah.
Was he an exosensualist? Was? Did he support the existentialism?
Existentialism is really born more after the war than before the war. Frankly, Bonhoeffer was sort of, it certainly has roots in the First World War, but I guess I think of it more as more of a post-World War II phenomenon. But Bonhoeffer did have very disparaging things to say of, what would you call it, an overly pious faith, or a person that is solely concerned about what's going to happen to them. Bonhoeffer, I wish I could pull the phrases out, but he was disgusted by people that talked only of themselves, thought only about themselves, anguished about, you know, their future or their fate or the bombings that were, you know, happening in Berlin.